Hi everyone, good evening, and welcome to our presentation tonight. My name is Katie Aranges, and I'm joined by Joe Schiazzi, and we're going to talk a little bit today about asparaginase hypersensitivity and silent inactivation. To start, we have no disclosures for today, and now I'll hand it over to Joe, who's going to start to give us an overview about asparaginase therapy and treating pediatric cancers.
Thanks, Katie. So to start going through the background of asparaginase therapy and why it's used so commonly in some pediatric leukemias. So the history of asparaginase was first identified as an anti-cancer agent back in the 1960s. It was identified really in guinea pig serum, and it's as an anti-lymphoma agent that existed in guinea pig serum. Lymphoblastic leukemia cells, we know, are not able to appropriately synthesize asparagine, which is an amino acid that's required for protein production and cell replication in all healthy cells, specifically leukemia cells. And these leukemia cells depend on that extracellular asparagine because they can't make it themselves. And when extracellular asparagine is not available to the leukemia cells cannot grow and will typically wither and die. In modern times, asparaginase that we will use is typically derived from bacterial sources, so including E. coli and Erwinia chrysanthemi. Talking about the specific mechanism of how asparaginase really works in leukemia is that asparaginase itself is an enzyme that breaks apart asparagine, that essential amino acid, into aspartic acid and ammonia. Asparagine, as I mentioned, is a vital amino acid that's really required for protein synthesis in multiple types of cells. But reduced availability of asparagine leads to inhibition of leukemia cell growth specifically. And then asparagine, when it's exposed to asparaginase, is going to be broken apart into aspartic acid and ammonia. Neither of those can be utilized by those leukemia cells. Looking at some asparaginase products that are available in the past and currently available, so native E. coli asparaginase, no longer distributed in the United States, not really used as often any longer. Mostly replaced by pegasparaginase or Oncaspar, which is a little bit longer acting asparaginase formulation that we'll talk about. Calaspergase pegol or Aspergillus, which is also a longer acting asparaginase product. Asparaginase Erwinia chrysanthemi, which is also not currently marketed in the United States. It was mostly replaced by asparaginase Erwinia chrysanthemi recombinant or Rylase, which is now available on the US market recently. As an alternative to asparaginase Erwinia chrysanthemi. So looking a little more closely at these formulations of asparaginase, as I mentioned, native E. coli asparaginase is not really distributed, not really used in the United States any longer, but it's still available in some locations around the world. Typically, when it was used, it was administered as an intramuscular injection and has a really short half-life. So patients do require multiple injections to get the efficacy we would like. Pegylated formulations have replaced the native E. coli asparaginase. So pegylated asparaginase or calaspergase pegol is typically given at a dose of 2,500 units per meter squared. It's given IV and no more frequently than every 21 days. So again, a longer acting formulation of that asparaginase product because it is pegylated. And then pegylated asparaginase or pegaspergase, also called Oncaspar is the brand name, is recommended a dose of 2,500 international units per meter squared IM or IV, and is typically not administered any more frequently than every 14 days. Typically, when it's given as an IV infusion, these medications are given over 1 to 2 hours. One infusion does provide 2 to 3 weeks of asparagine depletion. So again, these patients don't typically need multiple injections for that portion of therapy. And these agents became more long-acting because of addition of polyethylene glycol molecules to the product, which extends the half-life through reducing clearance of the products through the kidneys. Typically, they're used as first-line treatment options. I would like to note that calaspergase is only approved for patients less than 22 years of age, and the treatment of ALL includes multiple long-term use of multiple agents, of which asparaginase is just a cornerstone or part of that therapy. Other two agents we'd like to talk about tonight, asparaginase Erwinia chrysanthemi, which was derived from bacteria Erwinia chrysanthemi. When it was used, again, it's no longer currently available in the United States. It was given as either an IV infusion or an IM injection, but also has a shorter half-life because it's not pegylated. So typically these patients will require about 6 doses given over 2 weeks to provide a similar duration of activity for an pegylated asparaginase product. Typically, it's given either on a Monday, Wednesday, Friday schedule or an every 48-hour schedule. Asparaginase, Erwinia chrysanthemi recombinant, or Rylase, was derived from a modified Pseudomonas bacteria. Recommended dose when this is used to replace a long-acting asparaginase product is 25 milligrams per meter squared, IM, every 48 hours. The total number of doses for this product is gonna vary depending on what type of long-acting asparaginase product you're replacing. But again, it's approved as a component of multi-agent chemotherapy for the treatment of ALL and acute lymphoblastic lymphoma in both adults and pediatric patients 1 month or older who have developed a hypersensitivity to an E. coli-derived asparaginase product. And this was approved by the FDA back in the summer. Just to note, for both products, it's important to monitor bilirubin, transaminases, glucose, and of course, exams before giving any of the doses. And then every 2 to 3 weeks, or it's clinically indicated per the protocol. If any results are abnormal, patients will be monitored into recovery from that cycle of chemotherapy. And if any adverse reactions do occur, therapy is typically modified. So talking a little bit more about the newer product, asparaginase Erwinia chrysanthemi, looking at one specific study that was done, it was an open-label, multi-centered drug confirmation and PK study, looking at the use of this agent in 102 patients. Between 1 and 24 years of age. The median patient age was 10 years of age, which makes sense when you think about the patient population with ALL. 93% of patients had an adhere serum asparaginase activity, or NSAA, greater than 0.1. And this serum asparaginase activity is used as a surrogate marker for asparagine depletion. Going back to thinking about how asparaginase works, higher levels of asparaginase activity will result in lower amounts of available asparagine. So zucchini cells can't find that asparagine outside their cells, and then therefore they can't grow. Talking a little bit about common asparaginase toxicities, hypertriglyceridemia, liver toxicity is noted, and then infusion-related reactions, specifically with the pegylated products is a little bit more common than with the other products. And then severe toxicities include anaphylaxis, thrombosis, or an increased bleeding risk, and pancreatitis. As I kind of mentioned, the risk of infusion reactions and anaphylaxis is a little bit higher with the pegylated products due to the possible reaction to the pegylation itself. But the other toxicities are similar across all of your asparaginase products. However, some patient populations may have higher rates of toxicities based on their age and race. And so some providers across the country may see different rates of things like liver toxicity and other things like pancreatitis. The ability to rapidly identify and manage asparaginase-associated toxicities helps to ensure patients receive the maximal benefit from therapy. And so it's really important to watch these patients and ensure that they can continue on these products and making sure that they're safely doing it.
So now that Joe has given us a background on how asparaginase works and the different ways we can give it, the next step is to understand what hypersensitivity and silent inactivation are and what it means for our patients. So we know that up to 30% of patients who receive asparaginase can either experience a hypersensitivity or a silent inactivation. It's clinically important to know that premedications could reduce the risk of mild allergic reactions. So historically, premedications were avoided in concern that we would be masking allergies. However, now that we have therapeutic drug monitoring, we're able to make sure and confirm that patients do have true allergies. And if we are premedicating and masking any mild reaction, we're able to confirm that they are truly allergic. And like Joe said, it matters that we have these patients who are allergic or have silent inactivation to asparaginase because it's a cornerstone of acute lymphoblastic leukemia and lymphoma therapy. It's an important part of every pediatric protocol and is included in many adult ALL protocols as well. And we know from the literature that the inability to get all of your planned doses of asparaginase actually has prognostic implications for patients with ALL, meaning that patients who don't get all of their asparaginase have significantly worse outcomes than those who do. Then the question is, what are the differences? What does it mean if you have a patient with a hypersensitivity or a patient with silent inactivation? So they are both antibody-mediated responses, but in hypersensitivity reactions, you actually see clinical symptoms during the infusion. In silent inactivation, patients won't have observable symptoms during the infusion, and so the only way to detect it is by monitoring therapeutic drug levels. So clinical hypersensitivity reactions happen because an anti-asparaginase antibody is produced. So asparaginase, like Joe said, is a protein that comes from bacterial origin, and that can cause, when it's given to a patient, for the patient to develop an immune response. That immune response causes an anti-asparaginase antibody to be produced, and then the antibody actually binds to the asparaginase molecule and reduces the activity of the drug, which means that you probably, most likely, would have a low level of asparaginase activity. The hallmark of hypersensitivity is that the patient has an outward clinical change or an outward symptom. And these can be in a variety of severity forms and can be in a bunch of different things. So the most common things we think about are bronchospasm, urticaria, angioedema, anaphylaxis, rashes. I think it's commonly thought that the degree of reaction you have is related to the amount of anti-asparaginase antibodies, but we know that patients who have these lower grade clinical hypersensitivities still have formation of anti-asparaginase antibodies and have lower drug levels. Compared to hypersensitivity, silent inactivation still results in an antibody formation, but patients can have one of two manifestations with this. One is that you have no outward clinical symptoms of an immune-mediated response, or these patients would have had a mild grade 1 or grade 2 response, but were masking it by giving pre-medication. Because patients don't always have outward symptoms or may have mild symptoms, these patients are really hard to identify, and so treatment modifications are sometimes not made. It's way more common to experience clinical hypersensitivity symptoms if you have antibodies. And so, if silent inactivation goes unrecognized, patients could potentially be continued on the same form of their asparaginase with no therapeutic benefit. Because, again, with the formation of an antibody, you have a rapid inactivation of the asparaginase and you have poor asparagine depletion, meaning the leukemia cells potentially have more access to asparagine. There are some risk factors for silent inactivation. So pre-medication, especially with steroids, could increase observed grade 1 or grade 2 mild reactions. And there's a theory that inconsistent dosing of asparaginase, so increased intervals between doses, could increase your risk for the development of neutralizing antibodies, meaning that the antibodies actually have time to develop because of those extended breaks in between. I've alluded to this grade 1, grade 2, or mild reactions, but what does that mean? And so the CTCAE is a common adverse reaction chart that you can use for any sort of type of adverse event. This chart is for immune system disorders or for allergic reactions and anaphylaxis, and you can see that it goes from a grade 1, which is very mild, meaning no intervention is indicated, all the way to a grade 5, which is very severe and death. Typically, we think of a grade 1 or a grade 2 as a more mild reaction, and then a grade 3, grade 4 would be a more severe reaction. This is just an example of a modified grading scale that was made specifically for pegasparaginase reactions based off the CTCAE, but just putting it in some of the more common things that people expect to see with a pegasparaginase reaction. So again, going from grade 1, which is very mild, doesn't need intervention, all the way to a grade 4, which would require urgent intervention. The other thing that we have to think about when a patient has an allergic-like response during an asparaginase infusion is it or is it not a true allergy? And so an immune-mediated responses, so those like hypersensitivity or silent inactivation, the antibodies are actually being formed in response to the drug exposure. So for an immune-mediated response, you typically see these allergic manifestations happen within a few minutes of starting the infusion, and it can range again from those very mild flushing, rashes, to nausea, vomiting, bronchospasm, hypotension, and even respiratory distress. In non-immune mediated reactions, you have very similar symptoms, but the reaction is either due to the actual infusion or from a transient hyperammonemia from asparaginase metabolism. It's really challenging to tell the difference because they present very similarly, and so without therapeutic drug monitoring, there's no way to tell whether or not the patient is truly having an allergic reaction or just a non-immune-mediated reaction. So with the idea that there are patients who could have just an infusion reaction or a non-immune-mediated reaction, knowing that pegasparaginase and asparaginase products are so important to chemotherapy regimens, premedications have become more widely used as a way to minimize risk for patients having non-inactivating reactions to pegasparaginase. We know that giving these premedications does not have an effect on the actual activity of the drug. And so commonly, you may see drugs like diphenhydramine, acetaminophen, steroids like methylprednisolone or hydrocortisone, and famotidine given to patients. Again, just because infusion reactions or non-immune-mediated reactions are so similar to those immune-mediated responses, this is just the CTCAE guidelines on what an infusion-related reaction looks like. And again, you can see that they are almost identical. So grade one being very mild, meaning you don't need to do anything, all the way to a grade four, which is life-threatening, or a grade five, which is death. Nursing-wise, the management is going to be the same, whether you have an infusion or a non-immune-mediated response or a hypersensitivity. So going into the infusion, educating families on what the signs and symptoms of possible allergies may be, and providing anticipatory guidance on what to expect in the event that their child were to have an allergic response. You're monitoring the patient, their vitals, and their assessment. It may vary between institutions, but typically we expect vital signs every 15 to 30 minutes throughout the infusion, and then even post-infusion up to an hour. You're watching the patients to see, are their skin colors changing? Are they having changes in breathing? Are they having changes in their nausea, vomiting, in their mental status, and having emergency medications prepared and readily available in case you need them? If there is concern for an allergic reaction, the most important thing is to first stop the infusion and then get a new set of vitals and an assessment of the patient. And then simultaneously, you'll be considering giving emergency medications. After all of this, then it's time to think about documenting. And so things that are important to make sure that you're documenting include how much of the drug or how long into the infusion the patient was before the reaction was noted, what their symptoms were, what the interventions were, and any reevaluation done post the interventions. Emergency medication-wise, you may see some variation between hospitals. But common drugs that you will see given include IV diphenhydramine, IV methylprednisolone, IM epinephrine, or IV famotidine. And because we know asparaginase is so important in treating children with leukemia and lymphoma, we also have wording built into protocols and standards of care as to what to do in cases of severe allergic reactions or mild to moderate reactions that are reversible. And so considering sending levels to look at asparaginase activity, or should we be switching the formulation that we're giving to the patient? So these are all things that go into, based off of the documentation, the reactions of the patients, the responses to medicines, what the clinicians will do to make the next decisions for the patients. So with that, we're going to get into our first case study. And we're going to meet James, who is a 5-year-old with T-cell lymphoblastic leukemia with no reported drug allergies, and he has done really great with his chemotherapy thus far. He is coming to clinic today for day 2 of his interim maintenance chemotherapy, which means he's due for his next dose of pegasparaginase. He received his methotrexate and vincristine yesterday and did just fine with it. So before the asparaginase infusion was started, James had vital signs that seemed at his baseline. He was well appearing. He didn't have any cough, chest pain, shortness of breath, rashes, or hives. But 15 minutes into the infusion, he was noted to have a decrease in his pulse ox with an increase in his respiratory rate. His heart rate increased, his blood pressure went down, and he was sitting up with just noticeable increased work of breathing, a new cough with wheeze, and had an erythematous rash on his face. The infusion was stopped, and James received some emergency medications. He got famotidine, Benadryl, and methylpred. And 30 minutes after the interventions were done, he was sleepy, but his cough had resolved, and he had no new respiratory findings, and the rash on his face was fading. And his vital signs returned back more towards his baseline. So the question is, based on these vital signs and the reported physical exam findings, are you concerned that James is having an allergic reaction to his pegasparaginase? So correct, yes, James is having clinical symptoms of an allergic reaction. Based on the CTCAE grading, I would probably put that at a grade 3 to a grade 4 because he required IV medications, but didn't have severe respiratory instability that required epinephrine or further respiratory support. So then, based on this, is there a way to help evaluate if James truly has an allergy to pegasparaginase or if his reaction was just an infusion-related response? So the answer is yes. We know that we can use asparaginase activity testing to help differentiate if he had a true drug allergy or an immune-mediated response, or if he had a non-immune-mediated response or infusion reaction. So we would recommend that James should have an asparaginase activity assay sent, assuming that he was able to get over 10% of his planned dose. So with that, that'll bring us back into what are these assays and what do they mean and how do we interpret them?
Yeah, so talking a little bit about the asparaginase assays that can be used. So two common assays are readily available. There's an asparaginase activity assay that measures serum asparaginase activity regardless of the type of asparaginase that's given. Again, going back to higher levels of serum asparaginase activity means there's lower available amounts of asparagine available for those leukemia cells to take up and use. There's also an assay that looks at asparaginase antibodies and that identifies antibodies to asparaginase that may have developed. So again, those patients who are developing that antibody reaction that then goes ahead and reduces the amount of asparaginase that's available and producing antibodies that inactivate that asparaginase. The commercial products that are currently used really only looks at E. coli-derived asparaginase products. So that's really what they're tested against at this time. So thinking about what your asparaginase products are and the possible antigens, and so thinking about what are patients reacting to if they are developing a true hypersensitivity to one of your products. So with PEG asparaginase, patients can develop antibodies to either asparaginase or the polyethylene glycol. We know that polyethylene glycol is involved in other medications as well, both IV medications and even some oral medications and food products as a stabilizer. So it might be important to think about does that patient already have exposure to polyethylene glycol, and that's why they're reacting. Calaspergase pegol, patients can develop antibodies to asparaginase or the polyethylene glycol, but I do want to mention that this product does have a lower amount of polyethylene glycol used in the product, and so patients may have a lower rate of reactions with this product. Asparaginase Erwinia-based formulations do not contain any polyethylene glycol, so if patients are reacting to the polyethylene glycol, it's unlikely that they'll react to the asparaginase Erwinia-based formulations, but patients can develop antibodies to Erwinia chrysanthemi. Talking about the differences and when patients should be rechallenged, so if patients develop hypersensitivity to PEG asparaginase, they should not be rechallenged with calaspergase pegol, again, going back to the idea that they may be reacting to the polyethylene glycol content. And asparaginase Erwinia chrysanthemi recombinant should not be used in patients who have a hypersensitivity or anaphylaxis to other asparaginase Erwinia products or formulations. So either Erwinia chrysanthemi erwinase or chrysanthepase formulations that may have been used in the past. Thinking about when you should draw these activity or antibody levels in patients. So obviously, if patients don't have a concern for hypersensitivity reactions, that they tolerated the infusion, some centers may still consider obtaining serum asparaginase activity levels when those patients receive pre-medication before they receive their asparaginase product. it goes back to the concern that if you pre-medicate these patients, you may mask some of those very grade one, grade two, low level symptoms the patients would have maybe presented with before and mask that reaction. So thinking about ensuring that patients are still responding and getting the appropriate activity levels you want, even if they don't have a concern for a hypersensitivity reaction when you pre-medicate. Obviously, if patients develop an infusion-related reaction that's concerning for hypersensitivity, most centers will obtain serum asparaginase activity levels after the infusion stops and once patients are clinically stable. So stop the infusion, give their medications to help manage that reaction, and then go ahead and draw an activity level basically the same day they're in clinic. Repeat asparaginase activity levels are typically sent 3 to 7 days after that initial dose was started, and again, immediately prior to the next dose. Thinking through that, if they received a long-acting asparaginase product, for example, you want to ensure that they're having an appropriate level of asparaginase activity throughout the duration of expected therapy. Anti-asparaginase antibody samples may also be sent in some patients that have a concern for these hypersensitivity reactions. Really, again, to think about, is there a true antibody? Can you identify an antibody that these patients are developing that reaction to? So this is just an example of an asparaginase activity report that is sometimes received after you send these activity levels. So as you can see circled, there's an asparaginase activity assay result. And this is where most centers will use this to see how much activity is around, how much basically benefit is that patient still deriving from that dose of asparaginase. Looking at an algorithm that's sometimes used to interpret that serum asparaginase activity. So it goes back to thinking about, as Katie mentioned, documentation during and right after the infusion stops is really important because we're gonna look to see how much of that asparaginase dose those patients received to help interpret this level. And so if patients receive less than 10% of their intended PEG asparaginase dose, it's not typically, you don't typically have an activity level done because we know that those patients may just have very low activity levels because they didn't have enough exposure to the medication. If they have 10 to 50% of the dose administered, the activity level is typically sent after the dose and then 3 to 5 days after the dose was given. If patients received 50% of the expected administered dose, activity levels are usually sent 4 to 7 days after that dose. That result is going to dictate what you do in the future. And so if those first sets of activity results, when they're available, if they show that your activity result is less than 0.1, there's clearly a concern for inactivation. And so typically at that point, patients are switched to an asparaginase or Erwinia-based therapy, such as asparaginase or Erwinia chrysanthamine recombinant. If those activity levels at first check are greater than 0.1, typically we'll recheck, again, to ensure that patients are having the appropriate exposure that we expect. That recheck level is typically done either prior to the next PEG asparaginase dose or 5 to 7 days after that first level was sent. If that repeat activity level is less than 0.1, again, there's concern for activation. Patients are going to have more asparagine available to the leukemia cells than you want. And we'll typically recommend switching those patients to an asparaginase or Erwinia-based therapy, such as asparaginase or Erwinia chrysanthamine recombinant. If those repeat activity levels are greater than 0.1, however, it's telling us that these patients will probably derive the expected benefit from that PEG asparaginase infusion they received, even if they didn't get the full dose. And so typically those patients are continued on PEG asparaginase, but they may have continued monitoring or more close monitoring with future infusions. So interpreting these asparagine assays, again, goes back to thinking about, is this an immune-mediated or non-immune-mediated reaction? So since immune-mediated responses are characterized by the formation of anti-asparaginase antibodies, we would expect that anti-asparaginase antibodies neutralize the drug. So these patients are gonna have lower or non-detectable asparaginase levels. Because those immune cells are kind of recognizing this as something that shouldn't be there, it's helping clear it more quickly. And so patients are not gonna get the benefit you expect. In non-immune-mediated reactions, they're not gonna have the development of formation of anti-asparaginase antibodies. So it is still possible to experience an infusion-related reaction, even with the first dose, for example, but it's unlikely that it's immune-mediated. And therefore there aren't antibodies around. Patients should have normal asparaginase activity levels. But again, using the asparaginase activity level monitoring will help to determine what you should do.
So we'll go into our next case study. So Amy is a 15-year-old who was diagnosed with high-risk pre-B-cell lymphoblastic leukemia, and again, no reported drug allergies, received her day 4 of induction pegasparaginase dose without any issues, and comes to clinic today for day 15 of her consolidation chemotherapy. So she is due for vincristine and her next pegasparaginase infusion. Just thinking about Amy and where she is in therapy, what would be some nursing considerations for her given the planned chemotherapy for the day? So some of the key considerations would be, does Amy need pre-medications for her asparaginase infusion? If she needs blood products, do we need to think about timing the asparaginase around those blood products, either giving the blood products first or separating both by some time to make sure that it's clear if she were to react what she was reacting to? You want to make sure that the emergency medications are prepared and nearby. And you're also going to educate Amy and her family about the day. This is the second time she's gotten pegasparaginase. The first time she got it, she had just been diagnosed with leukemia 4 days before. And so oftentimes families don't really remember the pegasparaginase part of their induction and if what those reactions could be, what we're monitoring, and what we're giving pre-medications for. So it's really important today in clinic that Amy and her family are re-educated on what are some of the symptoms of allergic reactions, what monitoring are we going to be doing, and what pre-medications are we giving her and why. Amy, pre-asparaginase looks great. She doesn't have any cough, chest pain, shortness of breath, her skin exam is normal, and her vital signs look pretty good. 1 hour into her 2 hour infusion, her vitals are stable and she's sleeping comfortably after her Benadryl premedication. She doesn't have any rashes, no increased work of breathing, and no cough. At the end of her infusion, her vitals are again pretty stable, and she's tired but well appearing, is not complaining of any shortness of breath or changes in her breathing. She doesn't have a cough and she doesn't have any rashes. So, based on those vital signs and the exam findings, are you concerned that Amy has had an allergic reaction to her pegasparaginase? Amy hasn't had any outward clinical signs or vital sign changes that would suggest that she had an allergic reaction to her pegasparaginase. Amy comes back to clinic a week later and gets her asparaginase activity level sent. So the first dose levels are the ones after her day 4 of induction asparaginase, and post dose number 2 are post her day 15 of consolidation. So you can see that her first level was less than 0.014 and her second level is pending. So based on these assays, would you want to alter any of Amy's chemotherapy? So using the chart that Joe went over with us, based on that level from Amy's last lab, it is concerning that she didn't have an appropriate level of serum asparaginase activity, which means that we're not having that asparagine depletion that we need, and so asparagine would be available to any remaining leukemia cells. So looking at the graph, the chart, if you follow down, she received all of her dose, and then we checked a level, and her level was less than the detectable range of 0.1. And so there's concern that she would be a silent inactivator. And so if you follow along, this will bring us into our next question. Would you want to change the formulation of asparaginase that Amy is getting? So yes, we would want to change the type of asparaginase that we're giving Amy. The concern is that she had a true silent inactivation, so had those anti-asparaginase antibodies neutralizing the drug, and so didn't get the asparagine depletion that we need from her. And so if we did not switch her asparaginase, the risk would be that we're giving her suboptimal therapy. So we would want to discuss with the family the need to switch to another form of asparaginase to ensure that we're giving her the best therapy available. Since Amy received pegasparaginase, we would switch her to an asparaginase Erwinia-based formulation, which the current is the asparaginase Erwinia chrysanthemi recombinant. Just some considerations when we're making the switch for Amy is that the change in formulation of asparaginase means that we have to change the number and the frequency of visits that she needs. So in general, to replace one dose of a pegylated asparaginase product, we expect patients would need to receive at least 6 doses of an asparaginase Erwinia-based product. Rylaze or the asparaginase Erwinia chrysanthemi recombinant is FDA approved for every 48 hours as an IM injection. And so typically monitoring during and post the injection is still required to monitor for any further allergic reactions, and typically is about every 30 minutes until 60 minutes post the injection. So to wrap up our key takeaways from today, asparaginase is an essential chemotherapy for the treatment of pediatric leukemias and lymphomas. And because of this, the inability to give asparaginase to patients has been associated with worse outcomes. Patients can experience either clinical hypersensitivities to asparaginase products or can develop anti-asparaginase antibodies in the absence of clinical symptoms or have silent inactivation. Using asparaginase assays, we can differentiate between patients who have true drug allergies or immune-mediated responses or patients who are having non-immune-mediated or infusion reactions. And monitoring asparaginase assays allows for a clinician to monitor for silent inactivation and make adjustments in patient treatment regimens if necessary.